Today, don't hold your breath. The Property Imperative Weekly to the 29th of June 2019. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. One of the latest posts covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And today we look back at the week's events both locally and internationally and consider their implications. We start with the international context because, frankly, local issues pale into insignificance when we look at the global shifting sands. But then we also delve into the local Australian scene where the economy continues to miss fire. And if you want to jump straight to the Australian summary, you'll find the link below. But first to Wall Street, which advanced in heavy trading on Friday, with the S&P 500 and the Dow closing the book on their best June in generations, ahead of much anticipated trade talks between US President Donald Trump and Chinese counterparty Xi Jinping at the G20 summit, which is of course underway in Japan. Chances are little will emerge, though perhaps there will be a ceasefire in the cross-country rhetoric. Trump expressed hopes that his meeting with Xi will be productive, but said he had not made any promises about a reprieve from escalating tariffs. Both leaders want to save face, and both want to walk away from it claiming victory. So don't hold your breath. Whilst the US-China trade row is the major issue, Trump's spats with Japan and India over tariffs are also in focus. And the IMF warned that a failure to resolve the trade issue would knock 0.5% off global growth. And Fitch Rating just came out saying the imposition of the US of 25% tariffs on the remaining $300 billion of imports from China would reduce world economic output by 0.4% in 2020, and global GDP growth would slow to 2.7% this year and 2.4% next year, compared with their latest baseline forecasts of 2.8% and 2.7% respectively. China's growth rate would be reduced by 0.6% and US growth by 0.4% in 2020. But UBS said that the world is only one step away from a global recession and questioned whether the markets were ready. UBS has released a research paper where the investment bank reveals it's anticipating major changes to their forecasts, which would result in a global recession. We estimate global growth would be 75 basis points lower over the subsequent six quarters and that the contours would resemble a mild global recession, said UBS. The cause behind this will be the continued escalation of the US-China trade war. US market trading volume spiked amid the annual restructuring of the Russell indices in the US, traditionally one of the largest trading days of the year. In fact, all three major US stock indices gained ground at the close of the week, the month, the quarter, and the first half of the year. In fact, it's been a remarkable run. To underscore this, the S&P 500 had its best June since 1955, while the Dow posted its biggest June percentage gain since 1938, the waning days of the Great Depression. From back in January, after investors fled equities amid fears of a global economic slowdown and had sent stocks tumbling in December, the benchmark S&P 500 jumped 17.3%, its largest first half increase since 1997. And you can trace the turnaround to the Fed doing a 180-degree turn on rates. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 0.28% to 26,599. The S&P 500 gained 0.58% to 2,941. And the Nasdaq added 0.48% to 8,006. All 11 major sectors in the S&P 500 ended the session in positive territory. Financial stocks led the gains in the S&P 500 and the Dow after the big US banks passed the Federal Reserve stress test, with the central bank giving the companies a clean bill of health so they could boost dividend payouts substantially. The S&P 500 bank index gained 2.4% to 452. All 18 banks undergoing the Fed's annual stress test were given the all clear, although the central bank placed conditions on Credit Suisse US operations after finding weaknesses in its capital planning processes. The Fed's stamp of approval for Deutsche Bank was a major boost since it flunked the test in 2015, 16 and 18. And JP Morgan and Capital One passed the test, though both had to pare back their capital plans after initial plans showed that each would see capital levels drop below regulatory minimums under a severe economic downturn. As a result, the average bank would be returning somewhere around 10.5% of its market capitalization in dividends and buybacks from the third quarter of 2019 to the second quarter of 2020. Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and State Street Corporation, which received conditional passes last year, passed without conditions this year. And Goldman Sachs, which is not in the S&P Bank Index, was up around 3% to 204.53. That said, Fitch says that US banks are expected to report lower sequential net interest margins during the second quarter 2019 earnings season, as the Treasury yield curve has noticeably flattened. The Federal Reserve's more dovish tone and Fitch's expectation that the Fed will not raise rates for the rest of 2019 will likely be a setback for banks' margins, they say. Yields on earning assets such as loans and investments, which typically price off longer parts of the curve, have continued to fall, while funding costs, which typically price off the shorter end of the curve, have remained steady for the most part, they said. Lower long-term rates, combined with still strong competition from non-bank lenders for loans, should produce tighter margins. Though if and when margins fall and net interest income growth stalls, Fitch does not expect any material impact to ratings, as a net interest margin expansion had already been expected to taper off. In economic news, consumer spending rose moderately in May and prices edged higher, implying a slowdown in economic growth and benign inflation pressures, providing the Fed's rationale for a possible interest rate cut in July. Volumes on US exchanges were 10.26 billion shares, compared with the 7.11 billion share average for the full session over the last 20 trading days. The gains are tied to falling interest rates and the Federal Reserve's vow to support the economic recovery. The US 10-year Treasury fell to 2% on Friday, a decline of 6.6% for June and 25.5% this year. Investors have worried about a global economic slowdown. In addition, Trump has criticized Fed Chairman Jerome Powell for not cutting interest rates quickly enough. The yield curve is still inverted, with the three-month rate sitting at 2.10, up a little on Friday. 100% of traders expect the Fed to cut rates in July, according to one survey. Apple shares dropped 0.9% following its announcement that design head Joni Ive is leaving the company. And separately, the Wall Street Journal reported that the iPhone maker would move its Mac Pro production to China from the United States. The volatility index, which measures the implied volatility of the S&P 500 options, was down 4.68% to 1508. Asian markets fell on Friday as investors kept a nervous watch on developments at the G20 summit, with trade top of the agenda and a key focus on the much-anticipated meeting between Donald Trump and Xi Jinping. Traders are biding their time, pushing regional markets lower, with the Shanghai ending down 0.6%, while Tokyo and Hong Kong were each off 0.3%. But meantime, China's financial regulator and central bank made a shocking announcement. For the first time in nearly 30 years, China would take control of a bank, in this case, the troubled Inner Mongolian-based Bohsiang Bank, due to the serious credit risks it poses. This news, which some have interpreted as a mini Lehman Brothers-style bank crisis, emerged as China's central bank pumped $125 billion into the financial system following the collapse, which had triggered the first ever intrabank default in China, strangling credit to small banks and driving up borrowing costs. There are fears the tighter credit conditions will hit a slowing Chinese economy. Bohsiang was a smaller lender and made a $600 million profit in 2017. It had assets of around $90 billion, and non-performing loans were modest, under 2%, and its capital buffers would fit comfortably with the global demands of a Tier 1 bank. So it superficially, at least, looked fine. Regulators seized Bosheng, the first action of its type since 1998, but of far greater significance was the collapse caused by China's first recorded interbank default. The ABC quoted one analyst who said, "The Bosheng incident has challenged one fundamental belief of China's financial system. Interbank defaults are not possible thanks to a 100% implicit guarantee." Now that credit risks and counterparty risks have finally descended on this very core market in China's financial system, all the key players in the system have to figure out how to price risks in the new paradigm, and quickly. Chinese small to medium-sized banks combined have balance sheets as big as the big banks combined, but are far more dependent on interbank funding. The central bank immediately pumped around 600 billion yuan, $155 billion, into the system and halted a run on the banks by guaranteeing 100% of all retail deposits. For the record, the party line from Beijing is the collapse was an isolated case, with the Bosheng's majority stakeholders using the bank's funds illegally in one of his other investment businesses. But it does raise questions about the Chinese banking sector. It might be just one bank at the moment, but Société Générale sees the real problem as the spillover into the broader economy. While we think the central bank can avoid a systemic liquidity crisis, we are becoming increasingly concerned that the economy may pay the price of a more intractable slowdown in the coming quarters. The central bank may still have some work to do beyond targeted cash injections into the financial system. And of course, the broader economic implications for China and its trading partners, including Australia, could be significant. As the ABC put it, in short, what has just transpired is a bailout with Chinese bail-in characteristics. And in other words, this may have been the first domino to fall in China's banking sector, which earlier reported a record 268 trillion yuan, or $38.9 trillion dollars in liabilities, and 246 trillion yuan, or $35.6 trillion dollars in assets, both up roughly 8% year on year, and well over, listen to this, double the size of the American banking system. This is one to watch. And talking of troubled banks, Deutsche Bank continues its travail. Next year is Deutsche Bank's 150th birthday, but Deutsche Bank looks to present its latest turnaround plan to investors, employees and the public around the 24th of July. Their plan may be to eliminate up to 20,000 jobs worldwide and close entire divisions of the company's ailing Wall Street operations, and will also close possibly some portions of its struggling German retail banking business. But the public unveiling of turnaround plans has become an almost annual rite for Deutsche Bank. Since 2012, the bank has cycled through five chief executives, with each one taking at least one stab, and often more than one, at fixing its financial and cultural problems. Far-reaching strategic shifts, job cuts, and geographic retreats have been announced, only to prove underwhelming or be quietly shelved. This time, executives hope that the restructuring will be sufficiently radical to overcome the worries among investors, customers and employees that Deutsche Bank lacks a viable plan to overcome its weak finances and bruised reputation. Those concerns, as well as a swirl of government investigations and intense scrutiny of the bank's long-standing relationships with President Trump and his family, pushed Deutsche Bank shares to their lowest level ever this month. Of course, as we discussed already, in a rare piece of good news for the bank, the Federal Reserve said on Thursday that Deutsche Bank had passed the central bank's stress tests that examines its capacity to weather another financial crisis. After reaching their lowest point earlier this month, Deutsche Bank shares have rebounded slightly, ending at a low 6.16. Gold futures for August delivery was up 0.04% to 1,412. Gold was up nearly 8% for the month and nearly 9% for the second quarter and 10.3% for the year. Elsewhere in commodities trading, crude oil for delivery in August fell 2.07% to hit $58.20 a barrel. And members of OPEC will meet next week on whether to continue cutting production to support prices. Oil prices were up about 2% on the week, And for the year, WTI is still up 28.8%. The euro US dollar was up 0.02% to 1.1370, and the US dollar index futures was down 0.01% to 95.73. Bitcoin has been incurring significant volatility over the past few days, which is in many ways emblematic of the improving market conditions. Now, analysts are noting that the Fed's recent dovish stance regarding the economy is what sparked the latest crypto rally. But the question now is whether or not Bitcoin's status as a, quote, safe haven asset will be enough to continue propelling it higher. Bitcoin stood at 12,380, up 10.56% on Friday. But watch the development of stable digital currencies after Facebook's Libra announcement last week. Now Swiss bank Duker's Copy has said it is developing its own ERC-20 stable currency. The coin will be built on the Ethereum blockchain and will be tied to the euro, the US dollar, and the Swiss franc, and will be known as Duker's Cash. Stable currencies have been all the rage for more than a year. Initially, the coins were built to give investors a chance to put their money into crypto without having to worry about the volatility or price swings that typically strike mainstream forms of digital coins, such as Ethereum, Bitcoin, and EOS. While Bitcoin has been doing quite well as of late, it is still vulnerable to sudden and possibly unexplainable price drops, such as what occurred during yesterday's early morning hours. The idea behind stable currencies is that forms of crypto will be tied to less volatile, more stable assets such as US dollars or gold, giving the crypto in question less of an opportunity to experience price falls and providing investors with more peace of mind in the process. This is both a strength and a weakness. On one hand, traders have less chance to lose their money, but granted cryptocurrencies ever strike bigger numbers, stable currencies, which are designed more to remain as they are, probably won't join in, meaning investors aren't going to earn much either. In addition, there are still certain aspects of stable coins that are either confusing or difficult to understand. Recently, a report emerging suggested that Tether was still responsible for Bitcoin's meteoric price rise, which has been going on since early April. Tether's infamy began roughly 1 year ago when Texas finance professor John Griffin submitted a document that said Tether had potentially manipulated the Bitcoin price in 2017 during its first serious rally. The sentiment now, according to some crypto skeptics, is that this is still occurring. But other reports have emerged stating that Bitcoin's price rises have more to do with general market trends than they do with manipulation, and that this rally is somehow sturdier. Well, we will see. Hi, it's Liz Interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. So now let's turn to the local markets. The RBA meets next week, and the likelihood is of another cash rate cut. As Bill Evans at Westpac put it, the RBA board meets next week on July the 2nd. Westpac expects the cash rate to be cut by 25 basis points to 1%. Beyond July, we continue to expect a further 25 basis point cut, with November the most likely window for a final move taking the rate to 0.75%. As noted previously, we have brought forward the timing of the next move slightly from August to July. Our original timing was based on past easing cycles and the notion that a pause between cuts would allow for a smoother transmission process and clearer guidance through the RBA's statement on monetary policy. However, the explicit signals provided in the governor's most recent commentary have changed our assessment. These include that it would be unrealistic to expect that lowering interest rates by a quarter of a percentage point will materially shift the path we look to be on, that the possibility of lower rates remain on the table, and that it is not unrealistic to expect a further reduction in the cash rate. Importantly, the RBA governor has made it clear that the case for easing stems from a reassessment of labour market dynamics, specifically that the unemployment rate will need to be closer to 4.5% than 5% to generate a lift in wages growth. This means that while the monthly data flow, assessment of the balance of risks and the bank's forecast review cycle remains important, they are not the driving force behind current moves. With the unemployment rate at 5.2%, the bank's forecast envisaging little improvement over the next 2 years, and the governor on the record as saying the June move alone is unlikely to shift that path, the case for a July cut already looks to have been made. And CoreLogic added, as always, when interest rates are changed, there are winners and losers. For the most part, the focus is on the benefit of lower interest rates for mortgage holders. What is often forgotten in the conversation and has been throughout the current rates cutting cycle is how much lower interest rates hurt savers and disincentivize saving. Given cuts to interest rates for savers have been much greater than cuts to interest rates for mortgage holders, and savers are not that much of a smaller cohort than mortgage holders, it is reasonable for lenders to have greater consideration of the impact of the current ultra-low interest rates on this segment of the market. And according to the AFR, the good news, bad news on the economy is that the underlying cash deficit for the 11 months to May 31 in the current financial year has narrowed to $115 billion, down from $4.9 billion in April and $2.25 billion lower than the 2018-19 revised budget profile deficit of $2.37 billion. On a rolling 12-month basis, the budget is already in an underlying cash surplus of $1.5 billion, but that shot up to $13.7 billion. The much improved figures were driven by lower government spending, with total payments $1.7 billion lower than the 2018-19 revised budget profile, and surging revenue with total receipts at $1.4 billion higher than the 2018-19 revised budget profile. But look below the surface, and as Credit Suisse showed, their leading index of activity for infrastructure is falling, as is domestic demand. Or in other words, the surplus is a result of weaker economic activity and slowing household spending, which is far from good news. Now, the government, of course, may well celebrate a surplus, but in the real world, things are far from well. As the RBA keeps saying, the government needs to do more to get the economy firing. The latest auction clearance rates remained in territory, which many are claiming has improved, with a final result of 60.5%, and with Melbourne running ahead of Sydney at 68.9% compared with 60.9%. But again, I must remind you that these are on extremely low volumes, well down from a year ago, so there is still little to support the view that prices are on the rise. And CoreLogic's latest indices showed a mixed result. So looking at the annual movements in home prices based on the CoreLogic data, we can see that prices in Sydney have dropped more than 10% over the last year and is now bumping along the bottom. Melbourne is not far behind. Brisbane continues to slide. Adelaide fell a little over the last few weeks, but is now moving slightly more positively. And Perth continues to grind lower. And as a result, the combined cities average over the last year has dropped close to 9%. So looking at the individual movements, in Sydney over the last week, prices rose 0.03%. In the month, they rose 0.01%. In the quarter, they fell 1.22%. Over the last year, they dropped 10.2%, and they dropped 14.97% from their peak. In Melbourne, prices rose 0.11% over the last week. They rose 0.10% over the last month. They fell 0.82% over the last quarter and have dropped 9.35% over the last year and 11.09% from the previous peak. In Brisbane, prices fell 0.11% over the last week, fell 0.39% over the last month, fell 1.23% over the last quarter, and dropped 2.52% over the last year, and 2.51% from their previous peak. In Adelaide, prices fell 0.18% over the last week. They fell 0.49% over the last month. They dropped 0.5% over the last quarter. They fell 0.34% over the last year, and dropped 0.98% from the previous peak. And in Perth, prices fell 0.27% in the last week. They dropped 0.8% in the month. They fell more than 2% over the last quarter. They are down 9.16% over the last year. And from their peak, they're at 19.87%. And so the five major cities' weekly drop was down 0.02%. In the month, down 0.14%. Over the quarter, down 1.18%. In the last year, down 8.39%. And from peak, they're down 10.82%. And if I can just remind you again, those are averages. Of course, they mark considerable differences. And there have been a number of significant moves in other locations. So I've just put up a few here that you can look at. Again, averages mask. Just remember that. But Christopher Joy said in the AFR this week, the bottom line is that with more cuts coming and APRA yet to reduce its 7% serviceability test, the housing party is just getting started. It is, as a result, plausible, he said, that the RBA gets less than two-thirds of the lending rate reductions it would normally expect from a brace of standard cuts. That immediately introduces the need for a third cut, which may be why financial markets are pricing one in by the end of the year. The problem, of course, is that the RBA will get even less pass-through than last time, perhaps as little as 5 to 10 basis points. This presumably explains why RBA Governor Philip Lowe is suddenly talking about the limits of monetary policy and expressing a desire to see fiscal policy furnish more support. The problem with this logic is that Scott Morrison and Josh Frydenberg were elected on the basis that they would balance the books and deliver a string of surpluses. The only thing likely to stop them doing this is a threat of a full-blown recession. Now, Joy might well be too optimistic on price expectations, but he is not alone. Domain said that the residential property market will start to recover from a two-year downturn in the second half of this year, with house prices in Sydney to grow 2% by Christmas, followed by up to 5% growth in 2020. This is according to Domain Group's latest property price forecast. The only other capital city to see stronger price growth over the next 18 months is Canberra, where prices are expected to grow 2% in the next 6 months, followed by another 4-6% across 2020. Melbourne is forecast to see more subdued house price growth, but nevertheless an increase of 1% over the second half of 2019 and another 1-3% in 2020. But we know that lending remains tight so far, as the latest credit results showed, and we discussed these in detail yesterday in our post Credit Growth as Weak As. So looking at the annual movements to the end of May based on the RBA seasonally adjusted data, we can see that housing credit has dropped below 4% on a continuous basis. The credit for owner-occupied housing is at now 5.3%, and you can see that continuing to fall. That investment credit is growing at 0.5% over 12 months on an annualized basis. And personal credit over 12 months is down 3.2%. Business credit is just above 4%. And total credit is growing at 3.6%, and you can see that continued trend down. And finally, we can just look at the non-bank sector and how that compares with the banks in terms of their mortgage lending. And you can see there that the ADI annual change in owner-occupied lending continues to slide, but is sitting above the investment sector, which is pretty close to zero now. But the non-bank percentage change in owner-occupied lending is sitting at 10.7%, much higher than the bank sector. And the non-bank change to investors is 5.8%. And as a result of that, you can see that the total non-bank credit growth is sitting close to 10%. So we can conclude from that it's the non-bank sector doing a lot of the heavy lifting with regards to lending at the moment. And the fact of the matter is that regulation in this sector of the market is, I think, more limited than the bank sector. I think it's one area where APRA is still asleep at the wheel. And the point there is that weak credit means prices will stay low. And the bad news for the high-rise construction sector continues, with more construction firms shutting up shop and people out of their homes due to defects. For example, 6 months after cracks in Sydney's Opal apartment tower led to residents being evacuated on Christmas Eve, around half of the complex remains unoccupied, with 172 apartments still empty in the Opal Tower. The work is going to take months, and the owners have also been forced to pay a $2 million building insurance premium. Indeed, Opal Tower now faces a possible second evacuation if owners do not agree to raise a special levy to pay for the new premium, due to be renewed in August. An uninsured building would be uninhabitable. But the situation is even worse for owners of Sydney's Mascot Tower, which was evacuated a fortnight ago after severe cracking sent shockwaves across the complex. Residents were told last night that a return to the complex is unlikely, with repairs expected to take at least 12 months. The focus for engineers is now on the water table, according to Mascot Tower Owners Corporation. News.com.au understands several owners are now considering bankruptcy, as there is no established timeline for repair and the cost of remedial work is unknown. And talking of faulty high-rise development, you might want to watch the show that Edwin Almeida and I recorded the other day, where we went into quite a lot of detail around the underlying issues and made the point that there are many, many buildings across Australia that are defective and the costs are huge. And another issue to consider is how much illegal money has flowed into the property and construction sector. Australia has the weakest anti-money laundering rules in the world pertaining to property. SBS News reported that the Australian Greens would launch a motion in the Senate to enact the Tranche 2 laws when Parliament resumes next month. In a 2015 report, the Australian Transaction Report and Analysis Centre, AUSTRAC, estimated suspicious transactions from Chinese real estate investors in 1 year alone amounted to around $1 billion. Now, around 13 years ago, the Australian government agreed to implement the so-called Tranche 2 global anti-money laundering rules for real estate. Gatekeepers encompassing real estate agents, accountants, and lawyers in a bid to prevent illegal funds from flowing into the property sector. But nothing happened. Green Senator Peter Wish-Wilson told SBS News that changes were now long overdue and that he will be moving a motion in the Senate to enact the laws when it resumes sitting next month. This is, he said, good policy and is absolutely essential reform. It's been noted in the international community that Australia's laws don't go far enough. There is an appetite in the Senate right now to get these laws through, he said. But after 13 years on the back burner, whether the laws progress forward will be up to the coalition government and Labour opposition. And Adrian Kelly, the president of the Real Estate Institute of Australia, said, "We do need to remember that most estate agencies across Australia are very small businesses. We need to be mindful of the costs and red tape which might come about from whatever changes government decides." Given the tight connections between the property sector and Parliament, we suspect that this critical issue will remain in the too hard basket. But have no doubt, illegal funds have supported the property sector for years, as has, for example, recently come to light in Canada. And on property, hedge funds legend Ray Dalio fears further interest rate cuts by the Reserve Bank of Australia could further inflate the, quote, mini bubble in property, and that it will all end in tears. Because interest rates have come down steadily, there's been a pretty steady rise in debt, particularly related to property debt, Mr. Dalio said. Australia, like many other countries, is coming to the end of a longer-term debt cycle. The world is coming to the end of a longer-term debt cycle because when central banks can't lower interest rates, they have to try printing money. And finally, it's worth noting that in the recent ABS National Financial Accounts for the March quarter, there was a 2.9% decline in Australia's banks' gross external liabilities or offshore borrowings, and a 0.2% decrease over the year. One name paper was down $21 billion, bonds down $10 billion, and deposits down $9 billion. And that drove the quarterly decline in offshore borrowings by the banks over the past quarter, partially offset by a $10 billion rise in loans and a $4 billion increase in other categories. And over the year to March 2019, Australia's banks' offshore borrowings fell by $2 billion, with falls in one name paper down $15 billion and deposits down $8 billion, largely offset by rises in loans up $11 billion and bonds up $10 billion. The growth in offshore borrowings over recent years has been driven primarily by bond issuance, which hit an all-time high in the December quarter. When compared to GDP, Australian bank offshore borrowings fell to 45.7% of GDP in March, well below the December 2015 peak of 52.8% of GDP, and roughly the same as the pre-GFC peak. They also remain a key driver behind the bank's loan books, mostly mortgages, which also retraced 296.1% of GDP as at March 2019, but was well down from the peak of 211% of GDP in June 2016. The fact is this, banks heavily rely on borrowing overseas, and that's enabled them to push home prices ever higher, lifting the long-standing rise in Australia's net foreign debt at 57% of GDP in the March quarter, though down from a peak of 62% in June 2016. Without this external funding, the total value of Australian mortgage debt would never have grown so strongly, and Australian house prices would be lower as a result. But now, of course, liquidity is a key risk. If our economy falters, or worse, gets downgraded, banks' access to funds might be restricted. The same is true if an external risk hits. Either way, banks are exposed. And remember the reinforcing processes of higher mortgages and prices turning into an unproductive Ponzi economy. Yep, that's the one which Australia's authorities want to reinflate, rinse, and repeat. So to the local markets, the ASX 100 closed down 0.73% at 5,481 on Friday, while the financials index fell slightly to 6,353. The volatility index was higher, up 3.97% to 13.04. Among the banks, ANZ fell 0.6% to 28.21, CBA fell 0.27% to 82.87, NAB fell 0.11% to 26.72, while Westpac rose 0.78% to 28.36. Genworth, the mortgage insurer, was down 2.09% to 2.81, as Fitch reported that the underwriting profits of Australian lenders' mortgage insurers are likely to remain under pressure over 2019 due to top-line growth challenges and a softer housing market. At the same time, LMI business profiles are vulnerable to the possibility of intensified competition with the granting of a license to a new domestic player in January 2019. Fitch thinks that LMI premiums may not recover meaningfully anytime soon, although a recent proposal by the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority, APRA, to provide capital relief for the use of LMI to banks using internal models from 1 January 2022 may improve premiums once the measure is in place. But intensified regulatory scrutiny of mortgage lending practices and bank risk profiles from 2014 has reduced the volume of higher loan-to-value mortgages. This, together with increased lender risk retention, has sharply lowered LMI premiums. And APRA data showed sector gross written premiums fell 10% in 2018 to $927 million, and underwriting profits dropped 25% to $303 million. The sector's combined ratio rose to 49% in 2018, compared with 40% in 2017, alongside lower net earnings premiums, according to the data. The Aussie recovered a little this week, thanks to the US dollar weakening, to end at 70.21. The gold Aussie cross ended at 2006, down 0.25%, and the Bitcoin Aussie cross was up to 16,471 in continued trading today. So standing back, we can see several significant issues are bubbling along, and many are not going to get solved overnight. We expect the trade disputes to grind along. There'll be more pressure on banks, both locally and internationally, and given the weakness seen in household balance sheets, we expect the Australian economy to also continue to misfire. The truth is, rate cuts will not make a massive difference. And with the government on a surplus at all costs autopilot, things will not turn around that soon. So don't hold your breath. We're in for a long haul. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.